Welcome to Electronically Yours with Martin Ware.
Hi, it's Martin here. Electronically Yours, as always. Today's guest is a kind of national treasure, really. Claire Grogan, who used to be in Altered Images. She's a famous actress, singer, of course, been in, most famously, Gregory's Girl. She was in Red Dwarf, Educating Rita, worked with Bill Forsyth on Comfort and Joy. She was even in Father Ted and Skins and EastEnders. But she sold millions of records with Altered Images, and she put an album out recently where they reformed. She's done loads of TV. She's really an interesting and diverse person. So here she is, the lovely Claire Grogan. Tell us about growing up in... where did you grow up, actually? Sorry, I didn't write that down.
Well, I grew up when I was really young, right in the central Glasgow, right beside Glasgow School of Art, which is Garnet Hill.
Right.
Yeah.
I know that.
We grew up... it was 95 Hill Street was my address. And, I had a really... My mum and dad lived in a tenement flat, and I lived there with them and my two big sisters, and we lived there very happily for many years. And then we moved to the south side of Glasgow. And I guess I had a nice time growing up. I had a very close family, and they all love music.
That's handy.
Yeah. So yeah, it was pretty. I mean, my mum was a hairdresser, and my dad worked in Glasgow Fish Market as a fish wholesaler. And yeah, I mean, it was a busy kind of household, but yeah.
I grew up in a small house. I mean, a council house, and I was. Looking back, I can't think. I just think I was very happy most of the time. I can't remember being unhappy.
Me neither. I do think it was only when I was a bit older, Martin, that I actually realised that my mum and dad didn't have very much.
Yeah.
And I guess in some ways we just felt protected from that. I think they probably did really struggle with bills and, everything, but they never, that was never reflected in our sort of day-to-day home life, but when I look on it, I can see that there was quite a lot of struggle, but yeah. In amongst it all, there was always, there was always quite a lot of fun going on in my mum in particular came from a really fun family. She had six sisters, and they liked to party, they had a really tough life, all of them.
Right.
But they never lost their sense of fun.
Did you have musical instruments in your house? Did you have a piano or anything?
No, we had a record player. We had a dancette.
Yeah, and,
and there was quite often a fight to get to the the dancette to put a record on. So my great aunt Winnie though, who brought up my dad, she played the organ in St. Aloysius Church. And she was a headmistress and music teacher. So there was that, but none of us, I suspect my parents couldn't afford to send us to piano lessons or anything like that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if we'd have gone anyway, but I think that was maybe part of it.
So was it a kind of social music thing apart from church? Did you have sing songs or go down the pub or what?
Yeah, my mum came from an Irish Catholic background, so there was definitely Danny Boy was definitely much figured in our lives. But yeah, no, it was more they really were music fans. And both my mum and dad, they tell me you know, before they passed, they would tell us great stories about seeing people like Frank Sinatra at Green's Playhouse in Glasgow. Yeah, I mean, all the big stars came to Glasgow. You know, it was a big, you know, big music city. You know?
Oh, it has been, hasn't it, really?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, so Glasgow's the best audiences in Britain, I think.
I mean, I love the Glasgow audience. Yeah. You can't take them for granted, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Nor would I ever want to. But I'm always my most nervous playing Glasgow. I'm sure you must feel that about Sheffield.
Do you know, there was a thing in Sheffield which was... because we moved away from Sheffield when we started getting successful, it was always like the Sheffield audiences tended to be a bit, come on then, impress me.
Yeah, show us what you've got.
Show us what you've got and make us proud. And that changed later on with the whole 80s thing, because I think people just feel very fondly about the past. But back then it was like Sheffield it wasn't a kind of partisan crowd, no, for us. It was more like a kind of, yeah, it's weird to describe. It is now, but it didn't used to be. But so how your home, are you the Queen of Glasgow then when you play?
Well, I do have a good, people in Glasgow are really kind to me.
That's nice. So
that is cool. And last November, I got, they have the Scottish Music Awards, and I got a, you know, Legend Award.
Oh, wow. Well done.
So that was really cool. That was lovely. That was a really good night. Yeah,
it's nice when, I think anybody who survives in the music business for over 30 years should have some major awards, because it's a tough old business, isn't it?
Lots of it's crazy.
Yeah.
I think you and I are similar. I don't know, but I suspect there has never been an option out for us. We've just always opted in because it's who we are.
I think... positivity, isn't it? And you know, where yes is more or less the default answer to most things. You have to be careful sometimes, obviously. So tell us about your growing up in a convent school, because I'll tell you why I'm interested is because when I was growing up in Sheffield, I went to the kind of top grammar school. Yeah. And opposite where I used to... opposite where our school was, there was a convent school. And so it was like two packs of baying hounds after each other all the time, separated by a road and some fences, you know. It's quite interesting. And we always, in fact, I'd say probably four of my first five girlfriends were from the girls' high school.
Yeah. And,
so what was it? Was it an all-girls school?
Yeah, it was an all-girls school. And I had been to Notre Dame Convent School since the start of school, really, you know, age five. I went there and just went all the way through it. And it's funny because I loved being around girls and I've really changed my attitude about it, actually, Martin, because I loved going to an all-girls school. I really liked boys not being part of the daily equation. I think a lot of that with me was shyness. And I just thought there was just something really, always really felt good about girls together. And even when my daughter Ellie, when I decided to send her, when she had to go to high school, I chose an all-girls school for her, and it was a disaster.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and I suppose it really made me reassess all of it and made me think that, you know, I mean, I grew up in a very female-dominant family. You know, my mom had six sisters, my dad had two sisters, I had sisters. I went to an all-girls school. And so for me, it was just a little bit of doing with Ellie what I knew myself.
Right.
And because it went so badly wrong, it made me really question it, you know, and made me go, I think it would be much, you'd be much better off in a mixed school environment. And
well, in what way did it go wrong, if you don't mind me asking? You well, don't have to go into detail, it's all right.
I just think it's that culture of, you know, and I think this in general, not just about this, my daughter, I can't cope with this best friend forever vibe that goes on amongst girls.
Yes.
At a very young stage in their life. So it really sets them up for thinking, oh gosh, I don't have this BFF, you know? And I think a lot of that really gets to some young girl, well, get to anybody, you know? So I suppose it's just this, you know, there's just almost too much emphasis put on being part of the cool gang. I mean, I know that goes on at all schools, but it just, it was quite extreme. And if you just kind of recognise, I honestly didn't have that at school. I really didn't, you know. There was no, I'm sure there were fights, but none that I was ever really aware of. But I just feel this the social media thing, just the whole pressure on young people to be popular.
Oh, totally agree.
Drives me nuts.
And it's on a per like hourly basis, because they're constantly on the phones. That's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
It never leaves you. And even if you say, for instance, you're with your friends in the playground or whatever, and then you go home, and then it never leaves you because you've got that phone there. And it's just like leeching your self-confidence all the time. And there's a big fear of missing out thing as well, I think, with young people.
I think girls, I don't know, but I think girls feel that stuff a bit more than I boys, so. Just because a bit more surrounded by it.
I think so.
And also, going back to the fact that I absolutely believe in equality. And to believe in equality, that has to start from the word go, that there shouldn't be this kind of separation.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I was so convinced it was such a positive thing in my life, but it was at a different time, you know, because I was surrounded by the whole concept of feminism, really, to a certain extent.
Yeah, of course.
You know?
It's a given to a certain extent, yeah.
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 So I suppose in many ways, you know, it was just, you know, the natural progression has got to be that we all coexist in a much more equal way.
Oh, completely. Okay, let's move on to, have you always been a show-off?
I think
I know you say you were shy, but I think the two aren't mutually exclusive, you know.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, I think to overcome my shyness, a lot of the time I would be the one that'd go, okay, I'll do the crazy shit.
Right, right. And did that lead you into the wanting to go to drama school and stuff like that?
I think I absolutely loved being someone else. You know, I discovered that quite early on in school, that I could, you know, like just in that English classroom, reading plays and getting to be that someone else when you were reading a part. And I really loved that. I was really drawn to it. Also, I was, you know, I had incredible delusions of grandeur. You know, my mum was taking me to the cinema aged 4 to watch Doris Day movies. You know, I mean, I wanted to be Doris. I wanted to be that really super, you know, chic, working professional woman, you know.
Really?
Yeah. Oh god, yeah. And I knew I never even considered what I would do other than find my way onto a stage.
Really?
Yeah, it's really bizarre. Very, very bizarre. I mean, I applied for university and got conditionals and things like that. But, you know, the summer I left school, I made Gregory's Girl and I got signed to Epic Records. So
but just go back a little bit and tell us about your applying for drama school. And what did you do as an audition?
Well, when I mean, I never applied for drama school. I was in the Scottish Youth Theatre.
But you must have auditioned for that, presumably.
Yeah, and I did Pygmalion.
Oh, I see.
yeah. So.
So that's My Fair Lady, isn't it? Really.
Yeah. So I did the big speech in a Cockney accent.
And, did you?
Oh yeah, I loved that.
Do you remember any of it?
No, I should be able to reel it off to you, but I really can't. But many years later, a long, long time after, somebody told me that, you know, it was the panel were really, really blown away by my audition, which was really great to hear. But at the time, no one ever tells you that stuff at the time.
No. How old were you at that point?
14.
Jesus.
14, yeah.
And so you were confident.
I love, confident about being someone else, not about being myself.
But that's quite common with actors.
I've
always hung out with actors. And, in fact, a couple of my best friends are actors. You were in EastEnders, weren't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of my best friends is Ian Reddington, who used to be Tricky Dicky in EastEnders.
All right. Oh, God.
Tricky Dicky. I know. Probably not at the same time you were on. No.
That was quite a surprise casting call, I must admit, because it was the last thing that was sort of in my vision was EastEnders. And then my agent called me and they said they really want you to go in for an audition. And I was like, me? EastEnders?
I know.
I was some kind of wind-up. But actually, I had a really, really great professional experience there, I must admit.
Really? Okay, so let's go back to Gregory's Girl.
Yeah.
And the story is, obviously, for people who don't know, is that you were working as a waitress, is that right? In a restaurant. And Bill Forsyth spotted you. Is that the way it turned, that the way it happened?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a bit of a kind of, it's like something out of a Hollywood movie, isn't it? It's like going, that's the girl right there. I'm going to make her a star. Except
it was in Glasgow, and when he was with another film director at the time, Mike Radcliffe, and when they asked me for my phone number, I was like, no fucking way.
Really? You thought they were hitting on you?
I just thought, yeah, my mum has warned me about men like
you. Yeah, well, there's some point to that.
Whereas probably in Hollywood, the waitress would have been like, yeah, take me now.
Yeah, exactly. But you obviously went for the audition and got the part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, again, it wasn't so much as an audition as a drink in a pub or a really nice pub. Nico's in Glasgow was the kind of new wave bar.
Right.
So I met Bill there, and it was quite extraordinary, really. I mean, I look back on it and I just think, how the heck did that happen? You know? Well,
you must have been exuding this charisma that you possess. That's what I reckon. And then, so this was, I may have got the timeline mixed up, but how does that interlock with Altered Images happening?
Well, I'm around the same. I mean, when I was working in the restaurant in the spaghetti factory, I was still at school, so it was like a weekend sort of part-time job. And around the same time, my sister Kathleen was going out with a guy called Jerry McElhone, who was Altered Images manager. He's gone on to manage Primal Scream and You must know Jerry, you must remember.
Yeah.
So Jerry's wee brother, Johnny McElhone of Altered Images, Hipsway and Texas Beam, had started a band, and they were massive Susie and the Banshees fans, so they really liked the idea of having a girl singer. So I think initially they were angling for my sister, but she was like, having nothing to do with it. And she went, I think Claire might do it though. You know, it's just like,
all
very casual. Yeah.
Can she sing as well?
She, I mean, not really. I mean, I was in the school choir. That was the extent of my singing, yeah. You know. So she wasn't interested, so she passed it on to me.
That's a great story. I love that.
And then so I would, you know, I had no idea that I wanted to be in a band until I was in one. I mean, I was a massive music fan. I mean, probably like you, at the time, you were either completely obsessed with it or it passed you by.
Yeah.
I mean, but for me, it was everything, you know, getting to go and see, you know, everyone. You know, I still have such vivid memories of like the Two Tone Tour and, you know, the Susie shows, the Clash when they came. Yeah, I mean, just absolutely loved it.
I wonder, did you see, because we did, with the Human League, we did two tours with Susan.
Yeah.
Did you see the Human League, early Human League?
Yeah, I remember being backstage with you.
Get away. How did you get backstage? Oh, was that when you were famous?
Yeah, because we'd started supporting Susie as well. So.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Hey. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, well, amazing. So which tour was that? Was that 79?
I don't know. I mean, I mean, if I saw you backstage, I definitely saw you with Susie performing. I think maybe backstage might have been later when people were just hanging out after a show.
Right.
Well, I don't know where though or when, but it was probably in Sheffield. I don't know.
It could have been, yeah. Wow. Well, there you go. Learn something new every day.
Yeah. So, I was a massive Human League fan, still am.
Is that right? Cool. Yeah. Thank you. Early Human League anyway. What was your first single Happy Birthday?
No. Our first single was Dead Pop Stars.
I don't remember that tune.
Yeah, I think you'd really like it. Dead Pop Stars, I mean, we came from a real post-punk thing, and Steve Severin produced our first single.
Did he?
Yeah.
Good old Steve, I love Steve.
Yeah. He produced our first album, actually. So Dead Pop Stars was, it's quite, I still play it in my set, and people love it. It's very guitar orientated. It's very post-punk.
Yeah.
And it kind of, I mean, this is true. I can't quite remember the timing of it, but when we released Dead Pop Stars, it was not long after John Lennon had been assassinated, and somebody at the label said, I don't think this is the right time.
Oh, probably, yeah.
Yeah, and it kind of got withdrawn. I've never quite understood the sort of detail of that, but I think it was the right thing to do, don't get me wrong. But it was just like, for a long time, it's like, let's not talk about Dead Pop Stars, you know. And then we had another single out called A Day's Wait, which is pretty much an instrumental. And then the label said to us, listen, if you're serious about getting into the charts, you're going to have to do something a lot more instant, a lot more commercial.
Yeah.
And we decided to write some songs that just go for that big chorus. But Martin Rushen produced Happy Birthday, but we did do a version with Steve Severin as well.
Really?
Yeah, I'd love to hear that, but I don't know where it is. And then we did it with Martin, and Martin's one was the one that got released as a single.
Great single. And that was your first appearance on Top of the Pops as well, presumably.
Yes. Yeah.
And tell us about there's nothing quite like that first appearance on Top of the Pops, is there? Because it's like, the way I describe it is, it's no longer a theory, is it? Everybody on Earth, everybody in the UK knew that if you're on Top of the Pops, you're a bona fide pop star then. That includes all your family, all your friends, all your school friends, and their families, everybody. It was like that you have made it, even if it's like a minor hit. It's like, if you go to your grave, you were once a pop star, right? Yeah. And I just remember my parents, God bless them, were a little bit reticent about letting me, you know, I did it without their permission, is to give up a well-paid job to become full-time musician. And they went, oh, I wish you'd got a proper job, you know, and all the usual stuff. And I said, well, you know, I've got to give it a shot. And then as soon as you're on Top of the Pops, everybody goes, oh, wow, Martin, he's on Top of the Pops. Telling the postman and the dustbin man and everybody. And tell us about your experience of your first time on Top of the Pops.
I just have to mention my favourite Top of the Pops story is the one that Suggs tells about the first time his mum realised that he was actually even in a band was the night he said, Mum, I'm on Top of the Pops tonight. And wow. She was like, what?
I love that.
She didn't even know it was in a band. I love that so much. But for us, our Top of the Pops experience was a little bit different because Epic were so determined to get us in the charts that they had no... So when it was released, we did a pre-record for Top of the Pops with the hope that it would chart. So we hadn't charted yet. And the Top of the Pops agreed to let us do a pre-record. So
that's very cheeky. I've never even heard of that happening before.
Yeah. So we were sort of tagged on to the end of a recording of one of the actual shows. Wow. And then with everybody got their fingers crossed like this, that we would go high enough in the charts on our release for it to be shown, and it did. It was a gamble that worked. So
what number did it go in at?
I don't know. I mean, I'm rubbish at all that stuff, Martin. Right. But they showed us the next week. And I watched it at my friend Kathy McBride's house in London because we were down in London working. And we all went round to her flat, the whole band, and watched ourselves.
Yeah. Imagine... looking at yourself on the telly going, that's me, I'm in a band. Oh, fantastic.
But it was extraordinary because we'd literally, probably like you guys, I mean, we'd literally gone from watching Top of the Pops to being on it. In no time, in literally no time.
And how old were you at that point?
18.
Jesus Christ. God. That's amazing, isn't it? If you think about it. I mean, we were like 23, really. But 18, that's young. That's very young, isn't it? That's like Bros territory. So that led to you had a hit album from that, presumably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then so the record label's very pleased with it, and you're touring. Who are you touring, supporting the Banshees, you're saying? But then you started doing like headline tours, presumably.
Yeah, we spent probably the first year supporting Susie, U2, and Adamant. We did a lot of that. We did a lot of legwork, just in the UK, though, you know. And then we finally got to do our own sort of major headline tour on the release of our second album.
Right.
The one with Martin Rushen. And around that time anyway, we gigged a lot, but, you know, mostly in this country. I mean, we did sell millions of records worldwide, but we didn't really travel, you know. Right. I don't know why necessarily. We do all the sort of European pop shows like Music Laden and stuff.
Yeah, we did all that stuff, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, it was an extraordinary. I mean,
how did it affect? How did it affect your? I mean, did it go to your head? Or did it frighten you? Or did it? Were you overwhelmed?
Yeah, I mean, I think eventually it really overwhelmed me. I mean, for a long time, it's that arrogance of youth where you will just take things in your stride a wee bit. And because I had absolutely zero life experience, I just went along with everything. And then with the double whammy of Gregory's Girl coming out and being nominated for a BAFTA and stuff, and suddenly all the attention was on me. And I couldn't quite figure out how that or why that had happened. And I think the boys in the band couldn't quite figure out how.
Oh, right. Was there some jealousy thing going on, do you think?
Well, I mean, I just think that, I mean, to them, I was slightly like their annoying wee sister for most of it that they had to just take along. And, I mean, there was no real horribleness or anything like that. It was just, it just took everyone by surprise, the extent of the focus going on me in a way that's only
yeah.
And then we did a big tour in America, and I was being lined up for a couple of films out there and stuff.
Crikey.
Yeah, and I think I really came close to losing my mind. It all just blew up in my face. I was just like, I can't keep this up. I don't even know who I'm meant to be anymore, you know.
I think
it scared the shit out of me.
When you you mentioned earlier about being, at your most comfortable when you're acting, being someone else, and it kind of gets you away from the shyness and all that. But, you know, when that becomes an onerous responsibility, then that must have... I mean, were there any roles that you're up for that, for whatever reason, you didn't get, but that we'd know about, or any films that...
I mean, honestly, quite a lot of stuff, you know. I mean, I don't really like talking about the things that I didn't do.
Oh, no, I'm going to tell you, Claire. I mean, I'm perfectly happy not, you know, to move on. But I do honestly think whenever I get interviewed, I think it's quite healthy to talk about failures, because then it's not necessarily failures, but... The temptation is to present oneself as things always go pretty well, right?
I don't think I do that.
No. So, all right, moving on.
But I think you're absolutely right. You cannot survive the length of careers we've had with it not going pear-shaped on more than one occasion.
Oh, absolutely.
Something
is out of your control, isn't it?
Yeah, and I would never want anyone to think anything other than the fact that I have fought my way through this, you know, to still find a way of being relevant just in my own terms, let alone anyone else's, you know. And I think that is really important to acknowledge that it's not been plain sailing. My life has been... Yeah, and quite often I'm labelled as being this kind of happy girl,
yes,
you know?
Yeah.
And that doesn't... but I just always want to remind people that that happiness has come from lots and lots of places of unhappiness and getting out of that.
Yeah.
And I think you can only really feel truly happy if you've also experienced being really, really unhappy.
I agree.
And I know that may be stating the obvious, but people forget that sometimes.
No, I think you're right.
I've had a considerable amount of shit to deal with in life.
So let's switch track briefly to your acting career. So so you got your second album out. Did that have, how did that work out? Was that good? I mean, the singles, the performance of it, sales
of my new album.
Your second album.
Honestly, Martin, we did sell gazillions of records, but it was definitely a downward slope happening.
Right.
Even although we were selling hundreds of thousands, it was always like, oh, it's not done as well. I mean, it was a top 10 album.
Yeah,
it was number 7, whereas Happy Birthday had been number to.
Yeah.
So we were like, we put ourselves under enormous pressure.
Right. You know?
So that's why we did our third album. We thought we've got to rescue ourselves. And we did Bite with Mike Chapman and Tony Conti.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
That's cool. So Mike Chapman did one side of the album and Tony Visconti did the other. So we're working with two absolute legends. And I think it's probably the album I like the most out of the three. And yet when it came out, people like it a lot better now than they did then. That's all I'm going to say about it.
What was the big difference between it and the previous two albums?
I think we had really moved our sound. Well, I mean, apart from anything, Stephen, my husband, joined the band. And I think he gave us a little bit of a new twist in it, you know. So it was a lot more sequencer orientated and, you know, a lot more electronic, I suppose, to a certain extent, with a funky beat, you know, because we love Giorgio Moroder.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, so there was just a completely, and I think our audience weren't quite ready for it.
It must have come as a shock to them because it's not really what you were known for. But I'm always very happy when artists stretch themselves, you know.
Yeah.
It proves you're artists and not just some kind of, you know, baked bean salesman.
I love that David Bowie quote. It's something like, you know, if you're still making music in your comfort zone, then what's the point? And I kind of, that's not his quote, but there is something like that, you know, and I kind of agree with that to a certain extent. I think you've got to, you know, I mean, all of us, Martin, we were all experimenting in public. We were really young and we were just going for it.
That's right.
I loved us all for that.
That's right.
I still love for that.
That's right.
I really do. But if you can't take people with you, it becomes...
You know what? I think, Claire, it's more for me, I think it's about if you're going to fail on your own terms. You know, or if things aren't gonna work out, at least you don't regret. I mean, you know, if you fail and you've just kind of abrogated the responsibility for your own creativity to a third party. And that would be one of the biggest regrets of my life. I can look back and go, oh, we didn't really give it a good shot, you know. You're not always going to get it right, though, are you? That's the thing.
No, and I suppose, you know, Fight, I think, was still in a top 20 album, and Don't Talk to Me About Love has been one of our biggest hits ever. And yet we still were made to feel like we'd failed in some way by the label.
Right, how? Why?
I don't know. I think I really, you know, it just, do you know what? It just became exhausting dealing with the pushing and pulling of it all, you know. And I suppose, you know, I've always said I went back to Glasgow to make Comfort and Joy with Bill Forsyth. And, you know, it was the longest period of time that I was back home. And I just thought, I just can't keep be in this band just on the move all the time and feeling like I'm not getting it right all the time.
Right.
So I probably just needed a really good holiday, extended holiday. But you know, when you're that age, it's all or nothing. So I was just like, I can't do this anymore, and I won't.
I think, I can relate to that. I think it's, you know, do you think you made the right decision?
Yes.
Right.
I do. I think I suppose, it's quite a weird one because, you know, I did have a bit of a debate in my head when I did this new album, whether it would be an Altered Images album or a Claire Grogan album.
Right, right.
And for me, it became about a response to being in Altered Images when I was young.
Oh, that's interesting.
So it just made a lot more sense for it to be altered images, because I thought it's taken me a long time to really evaluate it and look at it. And because my daughter, because of lockdown and my daughter being the same age as me when I was first started in the band, I started really thinking about that, about how young she was. And at that same age, I was just about to sign my first record deal.
That's crazy, isn't it?
And it became a real reflection of what happened to me at 17 in many ways.
And the irony is, of course, that it's what you just said is looking at an altered image of how you were in the past. Anyway.
And also, I suppose for all the people that still turn up at my shows, when I do my, standalone shows with the band, and it's always been altered images. My band's always been, since this big 80s revival thing. I just thought, I have got to thank these people that keep turning up for me.
Incredible,
And the
isn't it?
best way to thank them is by creating something new for them to listen
Right.
to.
So, are you happy with your latest album? Was it a success in your terms?
Yeah, it was very much so. I really loved the, yeah, I loved the outcome of it. I really did. And I mean, there was no master plan. It really happened organically, for want of a better description, because I just found myself at home like everyone else. I mean, the number of artists right across the creative board who created new pieces of work because they were at home and they had nothing else to do, which really focuses you,
That's
because it
right.
makes, I just couldn't get over how much I miss singing and rehearsals. And because when the pandemic started, I was actually doing a play, so I wasn't even like gigging at that point. I was doing some theatre, but the thing that I really missed was being with my band.
Yeah.
And because Stephen, my husband, has produced some amazing records over the years, so I'm sitting at home with an amazing songwriter producer, and I just thought, Stephen, we will never do this again. Let's just see what happens. And we did. We started, and then of course we've got Bernard Butler involved. He's my neighbour. And when lockdown eased off a bit, I just said, Bernard, I'd really, but I didn't even know I was writing an album. I was writing a bunch of songs.
Basically, there's no downside to creativity, is what I always say to students when I'm talking to them. Like, no matter what you do it for, it could be for ambition, it could be for, but mainly it's got to be for your own pleasure and for the pleasure of others. It's a very important thing. So what was Universal Love School?
Yeah, that was another band I started. I mean I've always been not that far away from music. I've done lots of other things, but I've always had a sort of music project in the background, whether it's a band or if I've been writing stuff with Stephen for other artists or, but Universal Love School, I really, well, we were just, I mean, I don't even remember, is I know it sounds ridiculous, but I don't even remember too much about Universal Love School other than we had great fun and we did some really great shows. But we couldn't get a record deal, nobody was interested.
What
And
year was
eventually you just kind of go,
that? Sorry,
I don't know. I really don't. Late 90s.
late
Or
90s.
maybe early 90s.
Oh,
I honestly don't know.
wow. Okay.
I genuinely don't know. I couldn't even tell you the name of a Universal Love School song.
That's
No.
quite impressive. Right, where are we now? So. You write children's books?
Yeah, I mean, very occasionally. I mean, I did. I wrote a book called Tallulah and the Teen Stars, and it was during a really difficult period in my life. My mum got really, really sick and was hospitalised for months, and I had to find a way of distracting myself from the absolute agony of it.
Yeah.
And it made me think about my mum and I's relationship a lot, and about how, and about parenting, and I'm making it sound a lot heavier than it was in terms of what the outcome, but, and I'd also just adopted Ellie not long after that. My mum got, I'm so glad my mum got to see me being a mum, but there was an awful lot going on in my head about wanting to keep memories going. And
yeah,
I thought the best way I can describe to Ellie about how my very strict Catholic parents let me be in a band was by kind of creating a story around it. I mean, it's not completely biographical, but there's a lot of elements of it that are a bit like, you know, just nobody could stop me from wanting to be in this band. And in the end, you know, having supportive parents does play a part in it. And my mum and dad were supportive in the fact that they just let it happen. They didn't try to stop me.
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought I'd write this book called To Live and the Teen Stars, which is sort of very loosely based on my mum and I, you know, and just about coming from a very ordinary background and suddenly finding yourself in the back of a limousine.
But that's quite, that's like a tribute to your mum, isn't it, really, as well?
Yeah. Yeah, and to my dad too, you know. So, and it did really, really well. It was great. Got to number two in the Waterstones
chart.
Yeah. So it's a lovely, you know, lovely kind of thing to have made work. And I wrote a book number two, which didn't do quite as well, but it did well enough. And I do have a half written book number three, and I've never got around to finishing it.
Yeah.
And maybe it'll happen one day, maybe not, but my life is kind of busy. And also, I quite like enjoying myself, Martin.
Nothing wrong with that.
I love working. I love working, but I also quite like doing other shit as well.
Yeah, what other shit do you do then? What are your interests outside?
Well, I love traveling. I mean, that's my thing. I'm a bit of a nomad at heart, so I love to travel. And
where's the best place you've been to? Which country do you like best?
Oh my goodness, Western Samoa is pretty special. Which is really beautiful. I mean, I've actually worked on a couple of travel shows as well, so I have been able to see a lot of the world, which has been great. But Stephen and I went to Brazil just before the pandemic, really, and I absolutely loved Brazil. I've never been before.
Yes.
It was just great. I love the kind of mentalness of it.
Yeah. I went to with a charity that I'm involved with called In Place of War. I went to this place. It was a conference about creating new economic models for young people in Brazil. And it was in just on the outskirts of Brasilia, which is a wild, fascinating place. And literally about 2 miles outside the center of Brasilia, it's rainforest. You're straight into the rainforest. So this conference was taking place in the middle of this place that looked like something out of the Emerald Forest. You know, it was like waterfalls, parrots everywhere, monkeys.
Amazing.
And Lula came, you know, and gave a talk, and there was like, he just talked to people for 2 hours, and everybody sat cross-legged on the floor and going, this is a different kind of existence.
Yeah.
And there were like tribal leaders that come out from the rainforest to be with and talk about the effects of, you know, logging on the rainforest. And I'm going, this is just amazing. I love Brazil so much. And yeah. So I'm South America, I love as well. Have you done any traveling down there?
Well, I mean, honestly, Brazil and Mexico, I love Mexico as well.
Yeah,
great. But what I really want to do, and this is on my list, is I can't decide whether I want to go to the Antarctic or the Arctic. And I really, really want to see the icebergs before the...
Yeah. Interestingly, I'm involved in a project. Maybe I'll introduce you, actually. I'm involved in a project where I'm called Arctic Sonic with the same charity I'm working with. And we're going to do a big project in Greenland on one of the biggest glaciers.
Wow.
And it's obviously to bring attention to the global warming aspect. Uh-huh. That's going to be next year. And I should introduce you to In Place of War. It might be something that you'd be interested in.
Yeah, I'd love to. You know, I just like seeing things. And actually, it's just so, when you live in London, and although I spend some time in Scotland, and I love London, don't get me wrong about that, I just think the fact that I've made London work for myself makes me hugely proud, because I think it's a really tough city.
Oh, it is, yeah.
But I really love the idea that London doesn't mean a thing to some people. I love the notion that you can go somewhere and they don't give a shit about London.
Yeah.
And there's something very leveling about that I enjoy, that it allows me some perspective in my life, you know, and I think that's so important.
I can take that. Okay, we have to talk about True by Spandau Ballet.
We don't have to at all.
Oh, yes, we do. Look, it's well known fact, but I didn't realise it until we were together. And I realised that when Tony Hadley was performing True, that it was inspired by you, apparently. I know you don't like talking about it, but come on, spill the beans.
I mean, honestly, I think it's Gary's story for a start. He's the one that wrote it and has acknowledged on some level in his book, I think, that I was part of the inspiration behind it, but I was oblivious to that at the time.
He did come to see you, didn't he?
I mean, Gary and I were friends, you know, and I was genuinely really fond of Gary. I really was when I was young. And I suppose in many ways we had quite a lot in common. We were two young people brought up in council houses who ended up, you know, finding themselves in a really unexpected but much wanted place. And Spandau Ballet and Altered Images were quite pally, which seems really hilarious now because we were polar opposites on some levels, but I think we might have just done the same Top of the Pops together on a few occasions, and we just sort of bonded a bit, you know.
Did he take a shine to you?
I don't know, ask him. I'm not gonna
no, all right, I'm being naughty, don't worry. I don't know. I mean, I'm not interviewed Gary. He's got his own podcast anyway.
He does. He's yet to invite me on, unfortunately.
Yeah, he's not invited me either, the bastard. Yeah. No, I didn't mean it, Gary. And you do some radio presenting as well, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I have for a long time, just on and off. But I really love music. I mean, I know that is, you know, and it's just, I mean, I have ended up doing lots of different things over the years and not necessarily what I would have expected to do, but they've ended up giving me amazing experiences.
Yeah.
I really have. And I mean, years and years ago, I got asked to do radio and I just said, no, it's not my thing. I have a real respect for broadcasters, Martin. I genuinely do. People who really know how to do it.
I think it's tougher than you think, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's much tougher than you think. But people just kept on coming back to me. And it was usually after I'd been on a radio show, been interviewed, and then the producer would say, why don't you come and do a few shows for us? So it kind of got born out of that. And I really love it. I like it a lot better when I can choose my own playlist, which I'm not always allowed to do.
No.
But you know, that's just one of those, that's just the way radio works. So, but I'm always trying to squeeze as many things as I like and onto it.
Yeah, and we've got something in common. We're both mates with John Shuttleworth. And you've done his you've done John Shuttleworth's lounge music, right?
Yeah.
And me and Glenn also did an episode of, can't remember, he changes the name all the time, but one of his Radio 4 shows.
I love him.
He's got a laugh, isn't he, Graham?
Yeah, he's great.
I love him to death. And he's a naughty boy. He's always taking the piss. I actually did I did a show with him at the charity show at the London Palladium, and he got me. He managed to persuade me to do a version of Being Boiled with him.
I want to hear that.
So I said, I'm quite happy to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So what? How are we going to do it? I said to him, "Are you going to, you know, I'll sing the first verse and you sing the second verse." And he said, "Oh, yeah, okay then, Martin." You know, and he just didn't bother learning it at all. So I sing this first verse and we sing a bit of the chorus together. Comes to the second verse and I'm going, "Over to you, John," and it's like, "Oh, I don't really know what the lyrics are. Oh, nearly me. Not really sure. Oh, listen to the boys," you know, and it was a disaster. Anyway, it was funny. I think that's all that mattered to him.
Yeah.
Funny. And you're involved in the British Association for Adoption and Fostering, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's a noble enterprise on your part, because I think some of the greatest people I've ever met have been foster parents. I just think what an amazing thing they do to look after people in their development and then have the, God, to have to say goodbye to them and give them up as well. I mean, that's so tough, I think.
Yeah, fostering takes a very, very special kind of person, I think. I really genuinely do. And the British Association of Adoption and Fostering doesn't exist anymore due to lack of funding.
No.
But I still speak for Corum, which is the youngest, the oldest children's charity in the UK, who have a big adoption and fostering unit. And, you know, I've had to kind of pull back a wee bit from it. And the reason is, I feel that my daughter is at an age now where she needs some privacy.
Yeah.
And
when
I adopted Ellie, when Stephen and I adopted Ellie, we were evangelical about it. I mean, we genuinely were, Martin. We struggled for so long to become parents. And then this happened to us and we just couldn't stop talking about it. And then as Ellie got a little bit older, and she still comes to events with me at Corum and stuff, but I also, I mean, I know I'm talking about it now, but for in a weird way, it's just the one thing about being young is kind of not wanting to stand out too much. And I think that Ellie is amazingly well adjusted to most things in life, but I think that she still needs to be allowed to come to terms with this in her own time and in her own way, and having a mum banging on about it all the time.
No, I totally dig it. And
yeah,
if you'd rather we yeah, edited this bit out, I'm quite happy to do that as well. So just let me know.
Yeah, okay.
I'm thinking
fine
about it.
It really is.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
But not,
yeah, I mean,
not I just wanted to give you kudos for the, you know.
Yeah, thank you.
No,
and it's such an important, it was honestly, it's been a life, genuinely life-changing experience for Stephen and I.
Yeah.
I mean, I could tell you so many funny stories. I mean, she's just the best fun and, like all kids, super tricky.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have it anyway, you know.
Exactly.
But, and I really do like saying to people, you know, who struggle with fertility issues, that, you know, it's something worth, it's not for everyone, adoption and fostering, but it's definitely worth having a look at.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, it's something a lot of people go through, and it's normally prefer to keep it private because it's so painful when it doesn't work, you know, the IVF or whatever. We had a little bit of an experience with that, and it was, oh, anyway, you know, it was tough, I have to say.
Yeah.
But, you know, we go through tough things, don't we? And, you know, at least, you know, at least, you know, there are a lot of people, there are a lot of young people who need adoption. There are a lot of young people who need fostering.
Yes.
And, so I have nothing but admiration for your efforts. That's all I'd say. We're coming to the end of this fantastic. Oh, it's just flown by, hasn't it, really? Yeah. Didn't mention that you were in Skins as well. That's another thing.
Playing a naughty mum.
Right. I never watched Skins, but and you did Corner Shop Cook-Off.
Yes.
I read about that. Sounds fun.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've done a lot of different things, and yeah, no, it's all been good. It really has. I feel in a very privileged position, and I really genuinely do. But I think I also have worked really hard to keep it going, Martin, because, I mean, I suppose I know I'm probably unemployable in the real world, but I love what I do, and I'm not casual about it. I really am, you know, and so I'm always thinking, right, what can I do next?
Yeah, and that's a very good way to finish this conversation, I think, because I think that positive attitude generally bears fruit, doesn't it? But, you know, we've got to do these stupid questions at the end that I do for everyone.
Okay.
What's your favourite film? Gregory's Girl.
Do you know what? I'm going to say Breakfast at Tiffany's, simply because it inspired me on a level in terms of image.
Yeah.
Nothing else.
She looked gorgeous in that film, didn't she?
Yeah.
Favourite TV show, past, present, box set?
I loved Ozark, actually.
That was quite interesting, yeah.
Yeah, I really did enjoy Ozark. Yeah, so if you ask me that question tomorrow, it would be something different.
No, of course.
At the moment, yeah, Ozark.
It's only a little snapshot of where you are today, yeah. So don't worry, it's not an exam. There's no right or wrong answers. Favourite book?
The Great Gatsby.
Oh, interesting. Somebody else said that. I'm trying to think.
Always just read it every 2 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Which of your own work are you most proud of? And this could be music or acting, I suppose.
I'm going to be corny and say being a parent is probably the thing I'm most proud of. Quite serious parenting.
That's cool. Okay, going back to acting, which role, if you could wave a magic wand, would you like to play or to have played?
I thought about this recently and I came up with something super interesting and now I've forgotten what it is. I mean, I just like working, so keeping working is quite important to me. But, yeah,
I'll tell you, this is interesting. Is there a kind of weighty role? Because you're known for being the kind of, you know, exuding this sunshine thing.
Yeah.
But is there a kind of weighty role that you'd fancy a crack at?
Well, I mean, always, you know. I mean, I think that I'm quite good at doing the kind of the tragedy and comedy, which I've had the chance to do a bit. And as for straight drama, I haven't done an awful lot of straight drama. But, yeah, I mean, it's like I'm always open to anything. I really genuinely am. But I'm annoyed with myself because I just think, God, I'd really quite like to have a crack at that. And I can't remember what it is now.
What about any kind of classic roles, you know, women's roles in classical theatre?
Well, I mean, you see, the thing is, I've always been slightly against the snobbery attached to that stuff, mm-hmm. Martin, and I think Fair there enough. Is a snobbery attached to that. And I would happily play Macbeth.
Not Lady Macbeth.
Not Lady Macbeth. Macbeth.
Right.
I would.
Gender fluid Macbeth.
Yeah. You know, I think that, yeah, sometimes you just want somebody to see something in you that makes them go, that just takes you out of your box a little bit.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I suppose all of us find ourselves in a bit of a box. And. Yeah. But every so often I do definitely get to sort of, you know, I don't know. I mean, I suppose to a certain extent, I just love the idea that I keep going, Martin, you know, and because I think it's ridiculously hard. And I have got a massive CV that I'm actually proud of all of it. I really am. And I kind of love not knowing what's coming next. Which is quite advantageous when you work freelance.
Yes, that's true.
But I'm also at an age and at a place in my career where I kind of trust the fact that probably something quite interesting will come along. And that's really great. You know, I love the notion of that. But
cool. Okay. Which musical artist would be today's favourite?
I really like Little Sims.
Yeah, me too.
I think there's something really special. I went to see Self Esteem.
I think she's very interesting. She's from Monica the Woods.
Yeah, you know? She's from Sheffield.
Yeah.
I saw her the other week at the Apollo, and I thought she was phenomenal, actually. I thought she was great. I really, really loved her anyway. I think she's super interesting. And there's this guy from Glasgow called Joseph, who's my bass player Charlotte also plays with Joseph, so she kind of introduced me to him, and he just sold out the Roundhouse on Sunday, which I really wanted to go to, but it was Mother's Day, so I had other things going on, but there's a lot of new things.
Yeah. Cool. So, an epiphanal moment in your life, a moment of realization or a light bulb moment or a handbrake turn or?
I think probably the moment in my life when I decided that doing things in my own terms was the only way that it was going to work for me. And recognizing that authenticity is the thing that keeps people interested.
Totally, completely, 1,000% agree with that statement. And what I think my most overused word in all these podcasts is authenticity. I think it's the most important thing of all. And that can be authenticity to yourself, authenticity to your craft, authenticity to whatever you're trying to strive for creatively, and all the above. Right. Any particular unfulfilled ambition?
There's so many, you know, I'm really grateful for what I have done. But, and it just does go back to this thing about keeping going, just trying to find a way of staying sort of relevant, you know, because the competition is fierce and it's really good. You know, I think about that a lot. I'm glad that I don't have a jealous streak, because I look at other people with total, mostly admiration for what they're doing and how they're doing it, if it's something that interests me, you know? I love being part of a supportive environment. I really do. And, you know, I just want to keep keeping on, keep being asked to do things that surprise me, you know?
What I always say to people who have a kind of little hint of that, you know, envy of other people or fear of missing out or, you know, I always say, look, you can only ever be one person at a time. You can only be in one place at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And so provided you're doing something that you regard for yourself as being relevant or makes you happy, then you should never regret not doing something else. It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And you know, the other thing is, I mean, it's different for people of my age. You're a bit younger than me, but is nobody can have the experiences that we've had. I don't care who the fuck it is. I don't care if it's the Queen of England. I don't care if it's, you know, Marlon Brando. It doesn't make any difference. Nobody's got our experience. So you're not really, for instance, in competition, I don't think, with anyone, because you are Claire Grogan, right? You are a person that's been through all these experiences, a lot of which have been in the public eye. So you are, you know, a national treasure of a certain A grade, you know. And people know, you know, people would recognize you in the street in the UK. So you have a currency which you built up carefully over many, many decades, and you deserve everything that comes your way, I think.
Thank you, Martin. That's really lovely of you.
I mean it. And finally, mm-hmm. What's your favourite synthesizer?
I really wouldn't know.
Oh, you must have played with a few. Come on.
I'm thinking it begins with a K.
A K, a Korg.
Yes, I'll say a Korg.
A Korg. All right. Let's say it's a Korg MS-20. Let's call it an MS-20.
A Korg MS-20. I should know the answer. I'm just so not tech, though. Everything I do is into a little, the dictaphone on my phone or playing someone else's sounds. I love that. I've always got reference points, you know. I'll always go, it needs to start with the heart glass synthesizer.
Oh, bit, right. Yeah, but everybody does that.
You know, I loved, you know, I do listen to sounds a lot, but don't ask me what they're being played on.
To pay more attention.
I do. Well, I've got people around me that pay attention to all that.
I have people who can do the plumbing, yeah. All right, darling. Well, what a pleasure it's been. Thank you for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Martin. Thank you for asking me.
And
hopefully see you soon.
Well, we'll be on the same bill this summer at some point, won't we? I'm sure,
yeah.
All right, darling. Lots
okay,
of love.
Thank you, Angie. Take care.
Bye. Now, Claire, what an absolutely charming person she is. She has a fantastic work ethic, as people often do from northern towns. I can speak. I mean, I know loads of people from Sheffield and like that. And Glasgow's a good working class town. And, you know, opportunity has to find you prepared. And she's definitely prepared. She's a talented actress, talented singer, talented songwriter. And she's full of warmth and humanity. And it's always a joy bumping into her. Anybody who wants to contact me with ideas for the podcast, it's electronicallymartin@gmail.com and ideas for sections for the show. If you want to contribute to my Patreon, it's patreon.com/electronicallyhours. I'd really appreciate if you could help out. I put a lot of effort into this and I just want to ensure that we can continue doing it. That's it for this week. Hope you have a lovely week. Another great guest for you next week. Bye.